Good morning. You're listening to the Community Character Hour. We begin each episode with a newspaper clipping from the past. And what have we got today, Hannah?
This morning's article comes from the Northern Idaho News on March 23rd, 1906. Of all the people who had planned to have a good time at Archie O'Donnell's on the night of the 17th, it is doubtful if any met with a greater disappointment or had a more exciting trip than the party of 20 people who lived at Garfield Bay and Sagal who tried to go over to the dance. All had gathered at the Garfield Bay dock and were met by Captain McMurray, and the Idaho pulled anchor at 7:30 in the evening. It was one of the jolliest crowds ever aboard a steamer, and all planned on having one of the most enjoyable times. But when the boat reached O'Donnell's Bay, they found the sea rough and were unable to reach shore. Sam Miller then volunteered to take some of the passengers to shore in a rowboat. Mrs. Brandt, Mrs. Sutton, and Miss Voorhee got in, and they started out. The waves were so that the passengers got very wet, and the rest of the passengers would not go over in the boat. Mrs. Brandt ran to the camp for help and secured Frank Bryan and Paul Martin to act as the life-saving crew. Only Mr. Brandt, Mr. Sutton, and Mr. Van Emmett would go with the crew, the others remaining in the steamer. After a great deal of argument, the boat was headed for Garfield Bay and on their return found the sea to be very rough also. It was so bad that the passengers had to hold on to their seats to save themselves from being washed overboard. After some maneuvering by Captain McMurray, the passengers were landed and all returned home, much disappointed at the ending of what was to have been a pleasant evening.
Wow. Now, Hannah, is that the same Sam Miller? That's the famous Sam Miller?
I was trying to figure this out. So, the person Heather's talking about is Sam Miller. If you remember the old days of Pondere Pete, there was this amazing, like, bigger than life wooden statue in downtown Sandpoint for a long time of a man in like a little flannel shirt and a hat with a giant fish slung over his shoulder. And Pondere Pete was modeled off of a real man who lived here named Sam Miller, who was a famous kind of like just local guy. I think he ran the post office in Garfield Bay, and he was a big fisherman on the lake. I was trying to figure that out. I was not able to find an obituary for Sam Miller to kind of verify when he was born, but I think this could have been him, but he probably would have been a teenager at the time.
Okay.
So it's feasible, but not 100% confirmed.
You got me really excited there.
Definitely a young gentleman, if that is the case, trying to help all the ladies off the boat during the rough seas.
Oh, most certainly.
You're listening to the Community Character Hour. I'm Jack, and I'm here with Hannah Combs, director of the Bonner County Historical Society and Museum, and Heather Upton, who is the director emeritus of the museum. And we're joined this morning by Isaac Brown, who's a Sandpoint High School junior and a museum volunteer. And he's our guest, a historian focused on the steamboats of Lake Pondere. Isaac, welcome to the Community Character Hour. We're glad to have you here.
Thank you so much for having me on.
I would like to, before we talk about anything else, I guess, about it is historical. I want to ask anybody, have you ever had an evening like that on Lake Pondere? Hannah, Heather?
Ooh.
Have you had an experience with the? I like that they call it the sea.
The rough seas.
The sea is rough. It is.
It's the biggest body of water we know around here.
It's
I guess.
True. It is. It's more or less a freshwater sea, isn't it? Yeah.
I've had friends that have experienced it, and we've been warned because we do a lot of boat camping. But not yet, and hopefully I will not.
You've never been stranded out there?
Nope.
No?
Okay. I'm lucky that I started working at the museum and reading about the epic storms of the past before I really got on any boats in the middle of the lake. Mm-hmm. So I'm very conscientious of that now.
Isaac, have you ever been out on Lake Pondere in rough seas, as the newspaper says?
Not on any large boat, but I have had quite some fun on a small kayak.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
The big waves make it quite the ride.
They do. Yeah, you're right about that. Yeah, I woke up, I think I was camping at Green Bay once, and woke up to a stiff breeze and looked out, and the boat was really was pitching up and down at anchor out there, and we made it over to the anchorage at Garfield Bay. I was camping at Green. We got on the boat, scurried over to Garfield Bay before it really picked up. But it was, yeah, it was a little dicey. And then ended up staying at Garfield Bay basically the whole day, waiting for the breeze to die down so we could make it back to Sandpoint.
Oh, glad you made it.
I did. Yeah, likewise. I'm also glad. Okay.
Well, I was so excited the moment that Hannah talked about you, Isaac, and I'm so thrilled to meet you. And so tell me a little bit about how your passion for steamboats started. Did it start with a specific boat, a photograph, or a moment? How did it hook you in?
I think it goes back a lot further than just our steamboat. I think the biggest turning point was for me in second grade. The teacher had us all read a book about the Titanic.
From then on,
I was hooked with boats. And as time progressed, I slowly saw a picture here, a mention there of our local steamboats. And I really began to focus less on the big, famous boats that everyone thinks of, and to specifically look at the local little boats that I could feel personally connected to. And I could try to learn as much about, because there is really like an untouched aspect of our history.
That's amazing. And so you've been coming into the museum for at least a couple months now, going through our archives, kind of exploring the records that we have on steamboats here. Was there a point before you knew that the museum was a resource you could use for your research? And where did you look for information before that?
There definitely was a, I mean, I always knew that the museum would have a lot of resources, but for quite a long time, I never was able to fully, like, get out and try to look at them.
Sure.
And so I primarily relied on books I found and online resources, which there are an occasional few hidden collections of great articles on the local steamboats.
I do remember, I think, one of your parents coming into our gift shop a couple years ago, and they're like, I know exactly the right Christmas gift for Isaac is this book about the, I think, the one about the fairies. And I was like, this is a cool guy if he's like this age and into history this much. That's awesome.
Yep, it was exactly that.
So you've been coming in to our archives, and we have a couple, I know we have at least one big box full of just kind of like all sorts of ephemera, newspaper clippings, articles and things about steamboats on Lake Pondere. And you have been doing some pretty incredible work of kind of pulling all of that stuff out, spreading it all over the table, trying to piece together this belongs with this boat, this belongs with this boat, and kind of creating more organization for the archives that we have at the museum. What is your goal with the project you're working on, and what has that process been like for you?
I think my goal is to try to make those resources more accessible for everyone, and that when I first looked inside that box of steamboat information, it was scattered everywhere. Uh-huh. There was a loose assemblance of dividers showing which boat goes where, but the content behind those were completely mixed up and disorganized, and it really made it very confusing and not friendly to anyone who wouldn't have the previous knowledge to know that which information actually belongs with which boat or not. So my main goal is that I just want it to be more accessible, and eventually I want to try to put together all of that information and hopefully try to put together a book someday.
Yeah, I would love that. Yeah, I think, like, as you noticed in your experience, some of those books were sort of your entry point to that knowledge. And if you are someday able to put all of this disparate information together in a book format, that will be an entry point for other people to start to learn about the steamboats like you have.
There were, at one point, is it true that there were more than 80 steamboats on Lake Pend'Oreille? And I guess, how many of those steamboats that once ran on Lake Pend'Oreille still exist today?
Well, it is true that there were over 80. There has been, sometimes I've heard it mentioned that there were over 100. I don't believe that's quite true, but I think over 80 is a very safe bet. There is a very large list of larger boats that performed like big services and or for the public. And in addition to those, there were numerous other smaller private boats that I'm sure many of which are not remembered in the history books. But yes, there were a very large number of boats on the lake.
I always found it confusing. I did a exhibit focused on steamboats, and set like from a historical timeline, there'd be like a name and then another name and then parts of one. And through greater research, I was able to figure out that sometimes they like reuse things from a boat, or you know, it is the rabbit hole with the steamboat and recognizing, you know, what is what. So when you come across two boats like that, how do you verify, you know, the data that you've collected and the evidence that this is one boat, and how do you compare them? And if you find contradictory source materials in your research, how do you resolve that in terms of understanding and solidifying the history of each boat, fact-checking?
I think the biggest part is to try to follow the more, like, in terms of time, the more recent information, and that information given in like a newspaper article during the launching of the boat when that was current seems more accurate than 50, 80, 100 years in the future, someone writing it down somewhere. And so when there is conflicting information, of which there is quite a bit, I think it's best to try to look to either if there's more mentions of this certain information compared to the other, then I'd assume that's likely the more correct answer, or just the more relevant in terms of time period.
We also have quite a few photographs at the museum of steamboats. And I know I've seen you and other volunteers kind of, you know, holding up different photographs to compare, you know, like how long is this boat's hull versus this one? Is it the same boat? Did they repurpose part of it? What does the profile of the boat look like, to try to match them with the correct descriptions that you might have read in the newspaper too? So it seems like there are all kinds of clues you can look for.
You know, the biggest thing is that these boats were rebuilt a lot, and that all the hulls were made of locally milled, sometimes softer woods. And sometimes the big, like, sternwheelers and stuff, they would get a fully brand new replaced hull every 5 years or less.
Wow.
And so that a lot of these boats didn't have a long lifespan, and they changed substantial amounts throughout their lifetime. So that does make it difficult to try to compare and find out if two things match.
Okay, so it could be the name that changed, or it could be the substantial pieces of the boat that were switched out too.
Are you all familiar with the Ship of Theseus?
No.
It's a thought experiment going back to, I guess, to the days of Theseus, to ancient Greece. Which is, the question is, if you replace everything on a boat bit by bit, is it still the same boat? And I guess this is literally, usually it's a theoretical object that you're talking about, you know, but we're talking literally about ships, where you may have replaced every single thing on the boat, and does it still have the same, would you still call it the same thing. Or if you sell the hull of a boat and you replace the motor and it's a new, and you put a new name on it, mm-hmm. Does a historian still consider it the same boat, or is this a new boat?
And from a historical standpoint, the importance of renaming a boat if it's like a new boat, because mm-hmm. if you're trying to keep a name from remembrance, then it's so confusing because it could be multiple boats with the same name.
Wow, this is deeply philosophical this morning.
Yeah.
The terminology of the ship of Theseus, I think, is perfectly fitting for all these boats. I think one particular story comes to mind. In the 1880s, on Lake Coeur d'Alene, the government contracted to have a sternwheeler built named the Amelia Wheaton. And eventually, its old wooden hull became rotten, and so they replaced it. And then they replaced it again. And then eventually they upgraded it. They lengthened the boat and they rebuilt the top deck and they renamed it to the Elk. Mm-hmm. And then eventually they replaced the hull and replaced it again. And then they renovated it again. And eventually parts of it would become a very famous sternwheeler on Lake Coeur d'Alene called the Georgie Oaks. However, at some point, the engines would be removed and put into another Elk, and that Elk would be deconstructed and shipped by train to here, Lake Pend'Oré, where it'd be rebuilt, and it would be turned into another steamboat called the Juno. And then eventually, that boat called the Juno was renamed the Pend'Oré, and it was owned by the Humbird Lumber Company and hauled logs on the lake around the turn of the century.
So all of that happened in the 1800s.
That's amazing.
Yes.
Yeah. Wow.
That's a 20-year period, and that's a lot of boats in a 20-year period.
Four or five different, yeah. Mm-hmm. That's incredible. Huh. And then, so do you know if anything remains of the Juno / Elk / Amelia Wheaton today?
I would not imagine.
The whistle.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I need to go back to basics a bit because I'm not a boat aficionado. I know we've mentioned steamboats, we've mentioned sternwheelers. I've also heard some of the boats on the lake here called tugs. Can you explain just a little bit what defines different types of boats? Is it how they're used? Is it some physical feature on the boat? And what makes these boats versus ships?
I will have to admit, I'm not 100% certain on the boats versus ships thing. I've heard it may have something to do with oceans versus lakes, mm-hmm. freshwater versus saltwater. But in terms of these classifications, steamboat is really the catch-all phrase. Any boat that's powered by steam is a steamboat. And then sternwheeler gets into specific. Sternwheeler is specifically when you have the big wheel on the stern and over a propeller, or there's side wheels too, where you have a separate wheel on each side instead of one big one at the back.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a design feature. Okay. Now, a tugboat is a use case where a boat is tugging something, anything. Mm-hmm. On the lake, often there were barges, or a lot there were giant log booms being towed to the mills.
Yeah, okay. Okay, so it could be like a physical feature of the boat or its purpose that would classify it as a special type of boat.
Yes, exactly.
Nice.
I always liked the term steam launch, which were kind of like the smaller personal mm-hmm. boats that were for partying and kind of getting around.
Mm-hmm. So the size of these boats could vary from, like, what's the kind of size range mm-hmm. on a steamboat?
Well, some smaller ones was just mentioned, steam launches. A launch was simply just, it doesn't specifically have to be steam powered. A launch is just a small little open top wooden boat, or not always wooden, that sometimes they had engines, sometimes they didn't. Sometimes they were rowboats. And those could be as small as like 10 feet. And so steamboats, the smallest I'm aware of, are probably in the 20-foot range.
Mm-hmm.
And the largest to ever ply our lake was a sternwheeler called the Henry Villard, which was built in 1881 by the Northern Pacific Railroad to supply their railroad construction camps along the lake. And it was 150 feet long.
Wow.
So amazing.
Wow.
Yeah. There was a 150 foot boat on Lake Ponderay at one point.
Yes.
Okay.
And actually, it amazes me that this 150 foot long boat, they managed to get all the way up the Clark Fork River to the Montana border.
Wow. Wait, through the rapids at Cabinet?
No, so okay. they stopped right before the rapids. They couldn't get through the rapids at Cabinet Gorge.
Oh, my goodness.
But they could get all the way right below that.
Wow.
Okay.
This isn't specifically applied to, this is about all of these, like, stern wheel steamboats. A book I was reading about some in the Yukon, it said that some of them drafted, which is how much, like, how deep the hull went into the water. Some of them drafted less than 18 inches.
Really?
And some of them there were as big as 200 feet.
Wow.
And that these massive boats would pass over, it would go through rivers so shallow they would still scrape the bottom while only being a foot and a half deep.
Wow.
And one specific story that I've remembered is that during spawning season, when all the salmon are going up the rivers, the rocks kicked up by the salmon's tails would be tall enough that the boat would scrape along them every spawning season.
Wow. That's amazing.
I'm sorry, for listeners who, to kind of picture it, okay, I was just looking up the Shaunities, which is probably one of the larger boats on Lake Ponderay.
Mm-hmm.
That boat is 40 feet long. So
wow.
We're talking about a boat that's almost four times as long in the Henry Villard.
Would have been quite a majestic sight.
Indeed. Yeah.
Isaac, your knowledge is just, like, so incredible. The fact that you're able to remember dates and names and sizes. Do you have a favorite that really kind of sticks out to you?
I've gone back and forth a lot. I think I have multiple favorites in terms of looks, how a specific boat just aesthetically appeals. I do really appreciate a tugboat and, like, freight boat called the Ponderay, spelled not like the lake, but like the town.
Oh.
That operated in the early 1900s. But in terms of history, I think, and some people might be familiar with this boat, the Tai Tu on Priest Lake, which, because of its very long history, it was one of, if not the last steamboat ever built in Bonner County in 1945, and it worked until 1956. And I'm not entirely sure after that, but I believe it was still floating on the lake being used as a bunkhouse for loggers until the late 60s.
Oh, cool. I know when I first moved here about a decade ago, driving up to Lion Head at Priest Lake, you could still see kind of the skeleton of the hull poking up from the lake in that bay at the north end of Priest Lake. It was amazing. It was like our own little pirate ship wreck. And that was long before I ever knew any of the history of it. So now understanding that it was the Tai Tu, and it's just so cool to see all of that come together.
Yeah, it's amazing to me that the wreck is still visible. That was getting out and seeing that the first time myself really reinvigorated my interest in steamboats, and it really made me start to dive extremely deep into the subject. And I just find it amazing that it is left in a position where we can still see it, as so many of them are just lost, gone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And a monument to our Cap Markham.
Yeah.
Which we talked about in the last episode.
Yeah.
You're listening to the Community Character Hour here on 88.5 KRFY. This is Panhandle Community Radio. I'm Jack Peterson. I'm here with Hannah and Heather, as usual, from the Bonner County Historical Society and Museum. And our guest this morning is Isaac Brown. And we're talking about steamboats of Lake Ponderay and, I guess, of North Idaho in general. The historical boats that were used not just for pleasure, but for commerce and general usage, I guess, in the public interest. You had to have a boat back in the day before there were all these roads and streets around the lake. Yeah.
So something that you were talking about, the Henry Villard going up the Clark Fork River, up as far as the Cabinet Gorge. It reminded me of a couple stories I've heard. One was on the Pend'Oreille River over in Washington, and one was either on the Lolo or the Locksaw south of here. But stories of people racing steamboats, saying like whoever gets to Newport the fastest wins, I don't know, bragging rights. But there were a couple of these encounters where one or both of the boats got completely smashed apart because they were being reckless and crashed into rocks or something. I know kind of the centerpiece of our water system here is the lake, but we do have some sections of river that could accommodate boats of that size. Have you heard of any incidents of people racing steamboats on the Clark Fork or the Pend'Oreille?
I've not heard any mentions of racing on the river, but I know racing was a very, very common activity for these captains. It was a form of gambling. They would make very big bets on it.
Wow.
And as early as the 1880s, I know two boats, the Antelope and the Bluebell on the lake, were racing between Hope and Gold Creek on the lake.
Mm-hmm.
And I have not heard any mentions on our lake of large accidents related to racing. However, I have heard many on Lake Coeur d'Alene, which resulted in often collisions and even sinkings.
Wow. Man. It seems like a very expensive thing to bet something like that on.
It wasn't a lot to do back then.
Yeah.
So we talked about a favorite steamboat. Do you have a favorite steamboat story that you'd like to share with us?
This isn't a specific story, but one thing that really stands out to me is that there was a very large number of boats that were actually moved overland from our lake, starting at Priest River to Priest Lake, hauled on sleds behind teams of horses or later bulldozers.
Wow.
And as time goes on, I'm finding mentions that more and more of these boats, larger and larger, were shipped over. And it just really amazes me the amount of effort that would have taken, especially with the old roads back then and the fact that it had to be done in winter on sleds.
Mm-hmm.
And it would take multiple days. I'd have to camp out every day along the way, and it'd take like a week.
Mm-hmm. That is interesting, because my first question was, why wouldn't they just build the boat on site, wherever, on whichever lake they're going to use it? But I guess you have specialty skills, maybe, that aren't available, and some of the mechanical parts of the boats would have to be shipped in anyway.
Yeah, same with materials. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think the biggest part is that they were already put together. They had a boat.
Yeah.
You mentioned before Captain Markham, who built the Taitu on Priest Lake. He moved to Priest Lake in 1944 and started building the Taitu there. But before, he had owned a number of boats on the lake. And with that, he had shipped in a smaller boat that he built on Lake Pend'Oreille called the Ridley to join. And the biggest part was because he already had the boat. And taking it apart and rebuilding it would be a big endeavor. And so why not just take the whole thing?
That makes me think there were a lot of like independent captains that had different services, like the Bluebell with the mail. So I was wondering, was he racing? But there was the Northern Navigation Co. with the Elliott family. Were there a lot of other large companies?
Yeah. And I don't know if we know this, but when we were talking about the ferries, if you were a ferryman, it was very regulated by the county. You had to kind of have your permit and your license, and then there were kind of like caps on what you could charge and how much you could be. I think the county set their wages for the year.
Mm-hmm.
Were the steamboat captains regulated in the same way, or was it kind of a free-for-all for them?
Well, it would, for regulation, steamboats were actually a very free-for-all. There was almost no, well, there was no legislation for a long, long time. And even then, there was, after that fact, there was barely anything. And that's because throughout the entire state, there's only two counties where this steamboat navigation could really occur.
So in Boise, true, they don't care.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so you would find extremely dangerous business practices and operating practices.
Tell us about those.
I think a big thing is that often engineers would take a wrench and cinch down the pressure release valves on the boilers for an extra, a little bit of speed, which pushes the boilers above their operating pressure and really stresses them and risks explosions, which could spread fire throughout the ship and likely sink it, and a lot worse.
Wow.
But it sounds like one of those things where you're like, well, it hasn't happened yet, so we'll just keep taking the risk until we hear about a terrible.
Because they probably get paid per job, so it's like the more jobs you can get in a day. Mm-hmm. I also would imagine that you had the companies that had the financial backing to build the ships and maintain them. And sometimes a captain was a really great captain, but he didn't always have the funds to have his own boat or build a boat, so that he'd work for other people. So then you start to see like a few kind of monopolies in the small area, I imagine, so business-wise.
You had mentioned the Northern Navigation Co. Were there other kind of bigger companies running boats?
Oh, yes. Yeah. So some I've heard of were there was a short-lived Anchor Line, which operated a few boats. But really, the big one was the Northern Navigation Company. They had a very, very large collection of boats. They had a handful of passenger boats, but they also specialized in, you'll see mentions that they only owned 5 or 6 boats. But the more I read, I'm finding out that they operated tens of tugboats on the lake that they contracted out to all of the lumber companies and mills just on the in the county. And
was Northern Navigation locally owned, or was it owned by someone in like Walla Walla or Portland?
Northern Navigation Company was locally owned. So a man, Ed Elliott, he moved here around 1904, and he worked a number of odd jobs. He did some logging. He fixed shoes for a bit. And eventually he was offered the opportunity to buy a little old steamboat on the lake called the Nancy. And he bought the Nancy with a friend and a partner. And he began operating it on the lake, doing little cruises. And eventually he bought another boat. And, well, he actually eventually got the opportunity to buy the Big Northern from the Humbird Lumber Company, which was a freight boat and also used to tow logs. And from that, he turned it into the big, largest and most recognizable passenger boat at the time on the lake. And he then had constructed a slightly smaller but very similar copy of that called the Western, and he just added more and more and more. And he also, later on, moved to Priest Lake, and he partnered with Captain Markham, and so the Northern Navigation Company fully moved to Priest Lake, and they owned the Taitu.
Oh, so... Okay, when you were talking about the Northern being used as kind of this, like, pleasure cruise boat, I think, again, to the boats like the Shawnees that we have today, which are used in a similar way, but in my experience, you know, the Shawnees is kind of what you do when you have family visiting in town, and it's like, oh, I have people from out of town, we're going to take them out on the boat so they can see the lake. It's more of a tourism-based experience. Back then, you know, around the turn of the century, I'm guessing, you know, we had done a whole series on tourism before. People were kind of trying to figure it out, but tourism hadn't really become as big of a thing as it is today. So were the people going out on these just fun cruises on the Northern, were they locals, or were they coming through from somewhere else? Mm-hmm. You know, why were people taking these kind of fun boat rides?
It's really a mix. And so locally, a lot of these, not just the Northern, but all steamboats would sometimes just one day they decide they want to have a night dancing and partying with music and have fun. And so that by word of mouth, they'll say to spread through the town, there's a party on the boat tonight. And then that night, everyone will crowd on this boat and they'll sail out, sit out for a bit. And then once the party's over, it'll come back. And sometimes they'd load up barges too, with a whole band set up and entertainment.
Party barge.
Yep, we party barge.
Tie up.
Where is that?
So the Northern was big enough to have a dance floor on it?
Actually, yes. So when Ed Elliott purchased it for his Northern Navigation Company, he ran it for a while as it was, but then he fully refitted the boat. He replaced the entire engine to make it faster, smoother. He gave it features such as electric lighting, which it didn't have before, a full ballroom, dance floor, and even there is a stage for a live band inside, and there was also an electric phonograph, which was breaking edge at the time.
So this was not just dancing on the deck. There was a ballroom inside the boat.
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly.
A true entertainment ship. Mm-hmm.
And then for tourism, however, as the 20s really came on, that's when tourism started to really blow up. And so you'll find advertised in Spokane newspapers to where they could take the train to Sandpoint, spend the whole day on the lake on the Northern, meandering their way down to Bayview, where there'd be a train waiting for them back. And then there'd be music along the way, there'd be food and entertainment and the views of the lake. And it was advertised as just a day trip and every Sunday just to get away and do something fun.
We need to bring the Northern back. That sounds great.
How big was this boat, the Northern?
The Northern was 102 feet long.
Okay, big boat.
Yes.
And what became of the Northern? Where is it now?
Well, so...
Underwater.
Yeah.
Yeah. So in 1928, I believe it was October, the Northern was docked at the end of the Sandpoint City docks. Mm-hmm. And Ed Elliott's normal morning routine was he'd wake up, walk down to the boat, get the fire going in the boiler to start getting pressure. And then he'd go have his morning coffee and come back. And so this day, like any other day, he went, started the fire, and then went back home for his coffee. And when he came back, he found the entire ship in flames. By that point, it was completely gone. They called in the fire department in town, and they had a steam-powered water pump, but that also takes time to warm up.
Uh-huh.
So they were spraying chemicals, like their fire extinguishers of the time, on it, trying to get the fire under control. By the time that the big water pump was going, the ship was a total loss.
Oh my gosh. Mm.
And it sank in place at the end of the docks. And eventually, though, the mechanical components, the engine and everything, they're big metal. They're not burnable. So those were fine. So they drug the boat up, recovered those components, and then what was left of it was probably left to sink again.
So I imagine that the soul of a boat are the mechanical objects that could be carried.
The engines are the one things on these boats that that really carried a personality, because these engines, they'll last a century or more. They'll get used over and over and over again. Even if these boats sometimes last less than 5 years, some of these same engines will get used for ages. So what I read is that the Tai II up on Priest Lake, it was built in 1945, but the engine and mechanical components of it dated back to 1907. Wow. And they had been used on 3 or 4 boats before that, and they just get... They're taken out and dropped in a new boat just over and over and over again.
So this reminds me, you were telling me a story several weeks ago about a remnant from one of our local boats that made its way to New Orleans recently?
It wasn't specifically New Orleans, but it was somewhere in Louisiana.
Okay. What happened with that one?
Okay, so I mentioned this boat earlier, the Ridley. It was a smaller boat, about 40 feet long, and it was the one that it was built on our lake at Sunnyside, where Captain Markham had his shipyard, and it worked on the Lake Pend'Oreille for a bit. And then in 1944, when he moved to Priest Lake and started building the Tai II, he had that boat taken with him, and the Taitu and the Ridley worked side by side on the lake until the last log boom was towed in 1956, and then the dam was built at the end of Priest Lake, mm-hmm. preventing logs from passing.
So that was the end of mm-hmm. log booms then?
It was, yes. Wow. Although there were a number of later log booms, they weren't hauled by steamboats, but there were a few more log booms on our lake, Lake Bonderay, down the river. But it became increasingly difficult with the number of bridges and other obstacles. But so the Ridley, after, so in 1959, Ed Elliott, he didn't know what to do with these boats anymore. They were big boats and they didn't have a use anymore. And so the Taitu, he sold for, I'm sure, cents on the dollar to some loggers who used it for a number of years as a bunkhouse that they could move around the lake for wherever they're working. But the Ridley stayed just in place for a while, a long time. And I believe it was sometime in the 70s where Herrick Heitman, a wooden boat enthusiast on Lake Pend'Oreille, bought the boat and had it shipped back over land, back to our lake. And the boat was 100% complete and original. It had all the parts in it. It had just been sitting. And he built wooden motorboats, and he really just kept this boat because he wanted to save it. But it would take a lot of work and time. The wood was starting to rot. It was old. So the boat was built in 1937. So by then it was 40 years old. And so he drug it up on shore, and it sat on his property. He owned the Heitman Marina in Glengarry on the lake. And it just sat for a number of years. I found that he tried to organize a historical, committee to try to save it, but that never really formulated. And eventually he was getting older, and so he sold it to another man on Priest Lake who brought the boat back over. And...
Mm-hmm. Okay, so it was shipped by one collector from Priest to... It carried overland.
Yes.
Yes, to Pend'Oreille.
Yep.
And now it's been carried back for another collector.
Yes.
To mm-hmm. Priest Lake.
Just time and money.
Okay.
Yeah. I'll say...
Yeah. Get this guy going.
I believe his name was Gary Fry, and I believe this was in the 90s.
Uh-huh.
It was back to Priest Lake, and he had it set on his property on the shore, and he opened it up to the public at a staircase going up to it. And he said it would take a lot of work to get it in running working condition again, but he planned on replacing all the rotten wood and just keeping it on land, because it was, at that time, it was the last historic steamboat in the county.
Wow.
But eventually he was getting older, and the plan never really worked out. He partially took the boat apart and then never really got to putting it back together. And so it sold to another man who, unfortunately, at this time, the boat was very far, really too far gone. If you were to repair it, you would have to build everything from the ground up. And so this man removed the engine from it and took it with him to Louisiana, where he restored a 1908 Navy launch.
Oh, fun.
And that engine has since been restored and is in full working condition inside that 100-year-old engine.
Yeah.
That's an amazing story. I would like to just make the decision that the soul of the boat is the engine.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We've decided.
Yeah.
This is how it works.
Mm-hmm. Do you agree? Back to your theory?
Sure. Yeah. Why not? Yeah. It's the heart.
Yeah. And it can't die.
And
unless you melt it.
One thing I find funny is that it was originally a Navy engine. So I found that the Navy had a ton of standard designs for all everything from teeny little launches to giant battleships.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and oftentimes these smaller engines or even just whole boats would come up at public auctions and stuff. And so at some point, Captain Markham acquired, I believe it was dated to around 1905, this Navy designed engine from somewhere, and it worked in a number of boats on Lake Pend'Oré, and then eventually it stayed in the Ridley for all that time.
Wow.
And now it's all the way back into another Navy boat across the country.
That is so beautiful. Like
full circle moments within full circle moments.
So with the, I imagine that the engines would have all the identifying marks.
Oftentimes, yes. Sometimes, not really. Yeah. There were, in terms of larger manufacturers, there sometimes with Navy, it's a standard design. So you can, I mean, if it's shaped this certain way, it's that one. But in another time, manufacturers, they would almost always put their company name on that. Normally, they would occasionally they'd have a date. But sometimes smaller manufacturers and like local ironworks and stuff, not necessarily to us, but just local to smaller communities, would not have any identifying marks. So some things become quite a mystery.
So that is a huge mystery that you solved in terms of tracking that boat through all these different owners, different places, and figuring out where its soul wound up. Are there any other, like, what's the most exciting mystery you're trying to figure out now, next?
I believe, so my favorite one so far, most exciting, is that the shipwreck the museum recently found and made several articles about that can be found. And I've been trying to track down what boat that is. And I've been trying to, like, cross-reference based on its location, trying to find who it could have last been used by. And I found that this boat was likely a tugboat called the Coyote 2 that was owned and operated by the Dover Lumber Company. And it was, I believe, eventually just, it was nosed up on shore or close to shore at one point, and then eventually stripped apart and burned. And in addition to that, I added another part. Well, I found an amazing thing. So a man I got in contact with who gave me a vital information on the Ridley, he is a collector of old boat parts and old steam engines. And in fact, he has a large steam engine out of a boat that he said he found in a field somewhere north of Sandpoint. And he was bought for
that's where they are
bought for a very cheap price. And I'm pretty confident that that engine was pulled out of the shipwreck at some point by someone who felt like it.
Wow.
And so that we have another surviving remnant of another boat.
Wow. And that's, we do so have the anchor from the Coyote 1.
Well, actually...
Or so, Coyote 2.
Actually.
that anchor, I'm very curious as to the story of that anchor. My theory is that whoever owned and built both the Coyotes, there is a smaller Coyote 1, and then eventually that was taken apart and rebuilt into the Coyote 2, which still used the same anchor. And it's a very, very big anchor. It's bigger than any other anchor on the lake.
So this is an anchor that is currently displayed on the lawn outside the museum. So you can walk by and see it. It is a very large anchor. Mm-hmm. So it's bigger than like what would have been used on the Henry Villard.
And looking at historical photos and stuff, it's on this giant crane that precariously leans off the front of this boat, and it just dwarfs the boat. And so I would imagine it could be from maybe the ocean, or maybe it was made locally. I don't know what it's for, but it really doesn't fit the boats it was put on.
But there is a photo of it
on
the boat. Yeah, that's so bizarre.
Huh. That's really interesting.
It is. I mean, so you're basically the boat... The boat carries the anchor, and that's kind of the main purpose of the boat, is to drag an anchor around the lake.
Yeah.
It seems like,
pretty much. If you see the photograph on the plaque next to the anchor, you'll tell that it does not fit the boat it's put on.
Right.
Wow. Yeah.
I wonder what they could have been using it for besides an anchor. I don't know if they were using it to, like, dredge up logs that sunk or something.
Oh, that could be a possibility. Another thing is that even though it was a small tugboat, well, it was somewhat small, it was about medium size, It was, well, I'm not entirely certain on the length of the first one, but I know the second one was in the 70-foot range. But the anchor, though, they would be hooked up to, they'd be towing booms of logs that were bigger than some of the islands on the lake. And so that to hold all of that in place, they might need a very large anchor to really be weigh itself down and hook on the stuff.
What an incredible gift that we have Isaac in our community, being able to identify and solve mysteries and bring new light, you know, to this subject. So we talked about your future and how you would love to write a book, but I'm so excited to see what else you do. I mean, you could be delivering mail on a boat. Like, do you like to physically be on boats, or do you just like to more research boats? Or, like, I want to just know more about where you're going to take this incredible gift that you have and what you want to do with it.
Well, I personally love to be on boats, and I would love to try to recreate as much of this history as possible. So one of the biggest reasons I love steamboats is because the bridge between way back when second grade, when I got interested in the Titanic and my interest in these local steamboats, is I really got enveloped in the mechanics behind these steam engines. And so the engines themselves have really, just understanding all those systems and how they work together has really brought in me to appreciate a lot more things. And so I myself love to play with smaller model functioning steam engines, and I'm currently trying to build a model of working models of some of these boats on the lake.
Hopefully they'll end up in the museum. Archive someday.
Hopefully.
So special. Wow.
Someday we'll be going to a big boat party on the rebuilt Northern.
Yeah, could you under go Captain ahead Brown and build the Northern and bring back that culture of dance and mingle? Could be profitable.
Going back all the way back to the Northern that we were talking about, which sank at the end of the old city docks, is that, would there still be remnants of it? The city dock is now where Windbag Marina, or Windbag Marina is now where the city dock was, although I think the dock went out longer.
Yeah, so there is the large piled rock, little like elbowed pier that goes out and protects the little marina there. And that was the location of the original city docks. And it was originally built, it was a wooden trestle pilings that just went straight out instead of making that elbow. It went straight out, likely probably twice the length, and or even longer, because back then, before the dams, the lake's depth fluctuated extreme amounts. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes I'd have to be way out at the end because if the water level was low.
Right.
And so in terms of remnants, I have not quite had the opportunity to look specifically there yet, but I would imagine that there probably is some remnants, as after they salvaged everything off the boat, whatever was left of the wood, I'm sure they just let sink again.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure if in that shallow location it might be quite buried by mud and sand, but there likely is some remnants.
Yeah.
We'll have to go talk to our friend Chris the Diver, see if he wants to do an expedition.
I'm kind of surprised you don't see divers out there all the time. Maybe you do. They're underwater, so I suppose you wouldn't see them.
Would you ever be interested in being like a ship rescue diver?
That would be like really
shipwrecks
amazing.
Shipwrecks off the Caribbean.
But I mean, the city dock was there for, I can't remember exactly how long, 50 years or something
long
like that.
Time.
Yeah, so I'm you know, you would think there must be lots of stuff out
at the end of the dock.
You know, people drop their keys and stuff jewelry off the off the dock. Yeah, jewelry, yeah, out in that following that line where Windbag Marina, the parking lot is now, just can carry on out into the lake. Hey, we're coming close to the end of our program here. Our guest is Isaac Brown, and we're talking about steamboats on Lake Monterey here on the Community Character Hour. Let's see. I was going to ask more about just like steam engines in general, but we don't really have time for that. We got to wrap this thing up. So I guess Isaac, what haven't we asked you about? What if in our closing moments here, what would you like to talk about, or what's the last thing that we haven't talked about that we should bring to our listeners?
I believe people might be quite intrigued at the prospect of shipwrecks that we've been touching on. So one last story I'd like to put in is that I only recently uncovered this, and I found it pretty fun. So there was a smaller steamboat about 35 feet long called the Margaret M, and it worked around Bottle Bay, I believe, and hauled mail sometimes. And one day, it was in 1908, it was docked in Hope, and somehow it started leaking around where the propeller shaft was. And so, to prevent it from sinking, what the owner did was he started throwing rocks on the front to sink the front down and raise the back out of the water. Uh-huh. And actually, he was successful in this. He managed to do it fast enough. The boat was very weighed down, but it was just enough that the propeller came out of the water and it stopped leaking. And so then they managed to push this little boat that was very, very close to sinking onto a little rack on rails that they used to pull boats up into the dry dock, because mm-hmm. they had a dry dock in Hope to work mm-hmm. on the steamboats. And so they began winching this boat up. And then all of a sudden, the cable snapped, and the cart rolled back down. Oh. And then it hit the water, and the cart and the boat just kept going going. And that was the last anyone saw of the boat. So,
wow. So maybe another shipwreck afoot.
So, wow. And I'm not entirely certain, but I've heard that the dry dock may have been in front of where the hotel in Hope is, the old hotel. Ooh. So that might be a fun story for people to track down. I've yet to go over that area with the scanner on a boat.
This is 88.5 KRFY Ponderay, and you are listening to the Community Character Hour. It's 9 o'clock, and it's basically time for us to sign off. Happy Memorial Day to everybody who's listening to us live, and you can catch the rebroadcast later on in, it will be the month of June. Let's see. News from the museum, Hannah. What upcoming events?
Yeah, just a few. Not this weekend, but next weekend is our Free First Saturday on June 6th, as well as our hands-on history activities for kids. It's going to be from 9 until 2 this month, and it's a free admission, sponsored by Cindy Hayes. The Kinnickinnick Native Plant Society is doing their native plant sale that day as well in the park. And we have, thanks to our sponsorship from Flowers from the Heart, we'll also be selling dahlia bulbs that day. So lots of flowers, lots of activities. The museum's open and admission is free on June 6th. We will also start doing our historic walking tours of downtown Sandpoint, beginning in June. That'll be every Saturday from June through August at 11 a.m. And I believe we're going to be meeting at the Cedar Street Bridge this year. So keep your eyes open for tickets for that. And then mark the date, or save the date, on Sunday, July 19th. We will be doing the Pioneer Picnic at Lakeview Park. There will be food. There will be carnival games. It is just a joy to go for the watermelon seed spitting contest, panning for gold, you name it. We'll be doing it at Lakeview Park during the Pioneer Picnic on July 19th.
Cool. Hey, on June 6th, that same Saturday, after you go to the museum in the morning, come on down to Matchwood Brewing, where KRFY is hosting our 15th anniversary bash. And we're also launching a community can. This is the Matchwood Brewing does this program, kind of, I guess you'd call it, for various nonprofits, and they are doing one for us. Proceeds from the sales of this can of beer that you can buy exclusively at Matchwood Brewing go to this radio station. So go down and buy a 4-pack of our new community can called 15 Beers on the Air. Like 15 years on the air. Get
I
it?
Love it.
That's great. Yeah, it's
so
a pun.
Smart.
Anyway, that's on June 6th, though. We're going to have a big party at Matchwood Brewing. RFB is going to play music. We're going to be broadcasting live from that location. And I think it's going to be fun. Hopefully, Hannah, Heather, you guys coming?
Yeah, we will try to make it. Yeah.
We'll try I'll to make there. It. We'll try to make it, says Heather. Okay, all right, fine. But I'm going to be there, I tell you that. Isaac's going to be there.
Sounds amazing.
Right?
Maybe.
Maybe. Okay, it's open to all ages. Although, I mean, it is a brewery, but it's a very kid-friendly place, and families are welcome. You don't have to be 21 to visit us at that party on June 6th, the 15th anniversary bash for this radio station, which is a nonprofit. Okay, it is time for Bird Note. Anything else we should mention? Isaac, anything you would like to say in closing before we sign off here?
I'd say thank you very much for having me on. It
well,
was a really great experience.
This was a really delightful hour, and thank you for joining us, especially on Memorial Day. It's a holiday. Thanks for coming down. Do you have exciting plans for the holiday?
Yes. Not much more than the normal Memorial Day activities.
Okay.
Going and delivering flowers.
Yeah.
Oh, nice.
Well,
Isaac, I just have to say you are truly inspiring, and I look forward to following you and seeing what you do. And again, we're so lucky to have you.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, thanks for being here.
Okay, this is the Community Character Hour here on Panhandle Community Radio. Thanks for listening once again. And our guest was Isaac Brown, a historian from Sandpoint High School. And we're continuing on now with the rest of the day's programming. Happy Memorial Day, folks.